This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. On Wednesday, Governor Ron DeSantis finally did what critics had been calling for and signed a statewide stay-at-home order. Orange County's stay-at-home order had begun last week. Mayor Jerry Deming says the statewide order is the right call, even if it's later than he would have liked. Deming says the peak of this epidemic is likely still weeks away, and the death toll for the state could climb into the thousands. He says the next week will be critical as Central Florida hospitals prepare for a surge in patients. I talked with Demings about those preparations underway and about the economic impact of the pandemic, with 30,000 people applying to the county's emergency rental assistance program in just 12 days. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm glad to be on the show with you today. Hopefully we can learn a little bit from each other.
How long are you planning for? Like, what is the worst case scenario for this pandemic? If we're looking at a peak in, say, May, do you have the resources to get through that time?
We're going to have to get better. There's no question about it. I've seen data this morning that indicated that we won't peak in terms of the maximum number of cases that we'll have here within Florida until around the first part of May. And if that's true, we have some challenges. I've seen data that indicates that the worst case scenario here in Florida, we could be talking about as many as 179 deaths a day throughout Florida. And I've seen data that indicates that we could have nearly, before this is through the peak of the surge period of time, we could have nearly 7,000 different deaths here in Florida.
Those numbers are pretty frightening. What about hospitalizations? Because I guess that is the other number you must be looking at pretty closely. At this point in time, it seems like hospitals are coping okay, but when does that change?
Well, our goal really is to make certain that we are able to handle the capacity within our hospitals. And if we do a good job of mitigating the spread of the virus here within our community, then we just buy time to ensure that we don't exceed the capacity of our local hospitals. So the stay-at-home order that we have put in place, the curfew and the social distancing requirements that we have instituted as a community, all of those things put in place to mitigate the spread of the virus. If we're successful, perhaps we will not realize those numbers that I just shared with you that are being suggested or projected by different organizations that are studying this at this point.
Do you think that social distancing that you've put in place in the county so far is having an impact, or is it too early to say?
It's too early to say because we won't see the true benefit of these measures until after the surge begins to decline and we'll be able to go back and look at the metrics. We have seen metrics from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation that really has been used to give guidance not only to the healthcare professionals throughout the country, but from people at the federal level to those within the various states within our union have been provided most recently with some of the data analytics to be able to make the kind of decisions that we are making now.
Have you spoken to Governor Ron DeSantis? And if so, what kind of conversation have you had with him?
I had one brief conversation with Governor DeSantis, and that was when he came to Orange County last week to visit one of the state warehouse distribution locations. And I met him there. He had a press conference there. And just prior to the press conference, he and I exchanged just brief words during that press conference. So I have not had the opportunity to do a lot of conversation with the governor. However, I will say that the Surgeon General for Florida, I have had several conversations with the Surgeon General, with the Department of Health in Orange County, Dr. Raul Tino. I have daily conversations with him, sometimes multiple times a day. And so we do see some collaboration with the state. We obviously are a host county to a regional testing facility that is set up at our Orange County Convention Center. We stepped up to the plate and said to the governor and to the State Department of Health and Emergency Management that we want to be part of the solution. And so I'm happy to say that we are participating in that effort for testing that is occurring daily at our Orange County Convention Center.
This pandemic poses challenges on a number of fronts, right? You've got the health challenge, which, you know, clearly you're looking at some numbers that are pretty alarming there and worried about that. But there's also the economic question. We're already seeing an impact from that. I mean, the tourism engine here in Central Florida is suddenly ground to a halt. You have thousands of people out of work and looking for unemployment. What are your long-term plans once this pandemic part of the crisis is over?
Well, we're not unique in terms of the economic impact on our community. This is a global pandemic that is impacting the world's economy. The U.S. isn't immune to that, and Florida isn't immune, and nor are we here within Orange County. So our goal is to try to have a plan of action to recover as quickly as we can after we see the surge begin to decline. More than likely, that will come sometime this summer. And we are putting various things in place to be able to hopefully recover faster. I believe that with the pent-up demand that we'll see from individuals who have been socially isolated in their homes and even within their businesses, I believe that we're going to see a demand for some recreation. There is no better host than we are in terms of tourism and recreation than what we have right here in Central Florida.
It's Wednesday as we're speaking right now, and the rental assistance program that you launched a week or two back is closing. How much demand is still out there, do you think, Mayor Demings, and how much is this program costing the county?
What we put in place here in Orange County, we were trying to be proactive because I knew that individuals and families were hurt the most. And what we wanted to do was to have a short-term solution to be able to put some immediate funds in the hands of families to be able to pay rent. And so this was something to fill the gap between the point in time that individuals began to experience slowdowns in terms of work and when the federal or state assistance programs would be in place. And because there is always a lag with those types of programs from unemployment to the dollars through the CARES Act that certain individuals across America would be entitled to, we wanted to put something in place to assist our residents here in Orange County, and we used taxpayer dollars to do that. When we started out, we said that the goal was to reach about 1,500 families, and we were working within our existing budget of about $1.8 million. There's no question that we will exceed, the demand exceeds the resources that we have in place. So at some point, we'll have to have a conversation with the Board of County Commission about do we provide any additional dollars. We still have to manage our budget here within Orange County, but we had the financial strength to be able to put that program in place. We probably underestimated what the true demand would be for those resources, but we're doing the best that we can do to help the residents of Orange County.
A lot of businesses have had to lay off or furlough staff. I'm wondering, when you look at the county, is that something you might have to contemplate for county employees as well?
At this point, our county is in good fiscal health, but we certainly will have to look within our county operations to look for inefficiencies. For the time being, we're not bringing on any new employees. I believe that this pandemic will have a short-term impact on our local GDP. So having said that, I believe that we will very quickly recover. We have long-term strategies that we put in place to improve the overall economic outlook for our community, to take care of the social needs and the transportation challenges and all those things that we have to take care of in order to be the type of community that everyone wants us to be. And that's, you know, a world-class community. So I remain optimistic that we'll manage through this crisis and we will come out of it full speed ahead going forward.
The crisis has also kind of raised questions about what constitutes an essential worker, right? I mean, there's been a pretty narrow definition, I think, up until now, but now we're sort of realizing that people who work in grocery stores, you know, sanitation workers, there's a pretty broad umbrella when it comes to defining essential. How do you make sure that folks like that can keep working in conditions that might be dangerous because of the risk of this this virus?
For us, the priority really has been on keeping people working who support the life, health, and safety concerns of our community. And when you think about life, health, and safety, you know, that means securing our food supply, you know, our health supplies, our security, and all of those things really are the priorities for us. But there are a number of businesses that work around those particular disciplines that we've tried to keep working here in our community. There's no question that there's been a negative impact on many of our businesses, large and small within our community. But I believe with the CARES Act, the focus there has been on small businesses and individuals. There may be some corporate stimulus monies available with certain criteria. The goal is to minimize the number of workers who will lose their jobs. And so I'm just optimistic that that $2 trillion that the federal government is making available, we want to compete and make sure that we get our fair share of that $2 trillion within Florida as well as within our local county. All of that is designed to really meet the needs of the individual, families, and businesses. So I think we have a plan going forward. We now have to just execute that plan.
What kind of a hit is the tourist development tax revenue going to take from this? And I'm wondering if there are some projects that you might have to put on the back burner because of this crisis, just the drop in revenue from TDT money.
Well, with the cancellation or rescheduling or postponement of numerous conventions in our area, it is going to have a multi-billion dollar negative impact in the short term on our economy. In the long term, we've been able to book some of those shows or conventions that cancel or postpone to later dates. And so we're working to make sure that that is part of our strategy to recover economically as quickly as possible. So overall, you know, the future demand for conventions, for leisure activities within our community, Florida has a lot to offer. And because we have a lot to offer, I believe that we're going to kind of see this rebound occur here fairly quickly.
Just a final question, Mayor Demings, as a former sheriff and law enforcement officer yourself, what are your thoughts about the folks who are on the front lines, you know, whether they're deputies or police officers out there working through this? Like, what concerns do you have? And, you know, what would your message to those folks be working through this pandemic?
Well, we appreciate the men and women who are on the front lines. And those are our first responders and healthcare workers. We're asking our healthcare workers to do what they really see as their passion, and that's take care of the people when they're sick. The healthcare workers are stepping up to the plate to do that. Our first responders, sometimes we ask them to respond to situations when help is needed, and they're willing to do that. When we put them into that environment. We have to make certain that we equip them with all of the protective equipment that they need to keep themselves safe so that they can help others, not spread it amongst themselves, not spread it amongst their families. And so my hat goes off to all of those brave souls, those men and women who are willing to continue coming to work every day to take care of our entire community.
Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Still to come, even as testing ramps up across the state of Florida, it's not enough. That's according to Stetson University Professor Asal Johnson. She's an epidemiologist who has been watching the coronavirus closely as case numbers pick up in Florida and across the country. We'll have a conversation with Johnson about the epidemiology of the coronavirus. That's after the break. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Asal Johnson says more testing is still needed to fully understand the virus and stop it from spreading even further. Johnson's an epidemiologist at Stetson University. She says there's still a lot we don't know about the virus, which is one more reason to take the social distancing measures seriously in the face of this pandemic. Asal Johnson is an assistant professor of public health at Stetson University and an epidemiologist. Asal, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So, this is kind of an interesting and somewhat scary time to be an epidemiologist, right? You're seeing this virus, this pandemic, evolve in real time. Have things kind of tracked along the lines you expected, or are there some real surprises in what we're seeing in terms of especially how the virus is spreading in Florida?
Well, this is interesting. I've been talking and speaking about this pandemic when it used to not be called pandemic since January when we started the class, and we've been talking about it, and it's amazing how things shifted so fast before our eyes and before we even had time to catch up with that. So that is fascinating for me, that I've always taught about pandemics and about outbreak investigations. And now, you know, like at the same time that I am teaching this topic, I can actually use the daily examples of what is happening in our daily lives to analyze what is happening right now.
The reports coming out of China and other countries in Asia at the start of the year, what was going through your mind in terms of how the United States might respond? And I'm just kind of wondering, in the last couple of weeks especially, how has that response measured up to what you anticipated we might be doing by now?
Well, you know, Matthew, I remember in January I discussed the very early U.S. Respond to the outbreak when it was still concentrated in China. And I recall the early response was basically travel ban. We discussed how, if that would be effective from public health measures or not. And we all, with my students, came to this conclusion: this is not effective, actually, because it was crafted in a way that you would not go after the disease. You are actually going after people's nationality. And that is not how you detect the virus. Apparently, like, there were people, American citizens, who were traveling to that part of the world, but they came to the United States and they went undetected because the very, very early measure was just focused on basically screening people, they weren't even screening people at the very beginning, just basically banning people who were of Chinese origin, not even Chinese origin, basically people who were Chinese citizens. They could not come here, and we just thought that would be enough response. And then later, this was expanded to screening people who were coming from China. And we already knew that this virus might be still be able to spread while people are not showing some of the major symptoms, right, such as fever. But basically, we would just screen people in the airport by asking them about their travel history and whether or not they've been to China. And then later, we would ask them if they've been to Iran. And you would have all these asymptomatic cases that will go undetected, and they will go to their communities. And these people themselves didn't know that they had the disease or they were spreading them. This is how this actually virus went spread out silently for a while, and we basically just lost the track of it, and because we were distracted. There were other things that were going on. As you may know already, that the test that they eventually decided they want to use, the CDC had to come with own test. There was some technical problems with the test that kept us behind for a couple of weeks. And then, so there were so many different problems in place in the way United States at national level responded to this, which has got us to where we are right now. And then later you see that states, there are different states, some states were faster in taking this seriously, and some states were slower and, and would reluctantly, in a very slow pace, they would adopt some measures, and some states are still are at denial. They still are not doing much to to deal with this virus.
Do you think the United States is kind of at a disadvantage from the get-go just because of the way it is? I mean, we do have a lot of different states with different needs and ideas, and you are just going to get this patchwork response.
Well, when a public health crisis like this happens, it will be very helpful when there are there's some level of national authority, because that will help with the consistency of the measures that you are going to take. And right now, there is so much fragmentation in the United States. There are just so many variations in the way that states are going to deal with that. Even within states, it's not just that the state itself, like, for example, take Florida. Although there are some measures that Florida as a state is taking, but there are some others that are left to municipalities and states and cities. And that would actually cause a lot of inconsistency and some sort of fragmentation, which would make it easier for the virus to basically move around and keep spreading. Yes, that would definitely make it more challenging.
What do you want to see happen now? I mean, what steps could, say, authorities in Florida be taking right now to mitigate this? I mean, it's not too late to make the problem less severe in the next couple of weeks, right?
What I would say the most important thing is testing. Testing is not just to detect right now who has the disease. It's really important for us to have a good surveillance system in place so that we would know, we could actually see how the disease is, the spread of disease is proceeding right now, right? How do we know if actually we are going to get, or this situation is under control? How are we going to know? Without testing people and without having data that would show that the number of cases is going down over time, we would not know if this is under control. And that would not be achieved only with increase. We have to genuinely increase the number of testing for several benefits it may have. It's just because people who are positive, they would know, and they will be more motivated to isolate themselves. Also, people who are, you know, like who know they've been exposed to this positive, they quarantine themselves. But also, we would have a track of how if we are, the cases in Florida are increasing or decreasing over time.
Mm-hmm. What about the virus itself? Because it seems like every week there's something new about it. Like early on, we were told that people most at risk were the elderly, people who are immunocompromised or had underlying conditions. And there was also some mixed messages about just how contagious or just how infectious this virus was. It seems like the more we learn about it, it's worse than we initially thought. So what more do we need to learn about coronavirus?
So, you know, Matthew, because this is a new virus, so, you know, like it's very much, it should be expected that we have more questions than we have answers. The answers will, you know, will come later as we have more data. And that is actually expected with all new viruses, that as the outbreak is unfolding, we will learn more about them because that is also producing more data. So, but what I would say about the, you know, what we are learning about the nature of this virus and how would be a good public health approach to it is because there's still so many questions that are not answered yet, is best if we actually approach it as this is a very dangerous virus right now. And, you know, like we prepare for the worst and we are hoping it's not as bad, but we have to prepare for the worst, that it is a, we have to prepare for it. Like this is a very dangerous virus and we have to be cautious about it. And this is not about to get people scared. It's just, to make sure that people are vigilant and taking it seriously and realize what you are actually learning about this virus today may change tomorrow, literally tomorrow. So in the beginning, we thought that people would be contagious only after they show symptoms. But it's my understanding we still do not know if whether or not people can be contagious during their incubation period. Also, we still do not know for how long people are contagious. And the other thing that now is we do not know is that whether or not for how long, first of all, we don't know exactly how long the recovery takes. There have been variations of reporting in recovery time. Some people recover maybe in 1 week. There are some people who have recovered in, it has taken them more than 30 days to recover. So there is a large variation.
Even just the symptoms that people have, right? I mean, there's been a real range of symptoms and of intensity of those symptoms for a lot of different people who end up being unfortunate enough to contract coronavirus, right? So there's quite a range there.
It's a range, and this is pretty frustrating because now it turns out that some people who recovered after their recovery, they were still tested positive. So what I am saying, all these different different basically uncertainties about the virus itself, they can get us really frustrated because we don't know exactly how we should basically direct our policy. And that is why that will be just best for now to just prepare for the worst. And we are now hearing from Dr. Fauci that this is this American should be ready to have about 100 at least about 100,000 mortality. So maybe I shouldn't say at least, but I read in the news that he said that Americans should be ready to see mortality due to this virus going up to 100,000, which is a large number. So that is telling us this is a virus with when we've already seen the potential of this virus, it could be pretty devastating. And I think we have enough evidence to just know that we should take all necessary precautions and just be patient. We all have to be patient and wait for what comes out of evidence. And scientists are working on it.
Asal Johnson is Assistant Professor of Public Health at Stetson University and an epidemiologist. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, can a restaurant survive without its dining room? Restaurants across the country are scrambling to figure that out, and already many have closed, some permanently, in the face of this pandemic. We'll check in with a panel of Orlando food writers and creators after the break to see how Central Florida's restaurant scene is coping. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Restaurants are struggling to stay afloat during the coronavirus pandemic, with their dining rooms shuttered and only takeout service allowed. There are fears that some won't survive even as they cut back on hours, but there's also a movement to try and keep those independent restaurants viable. I reached out to a chef and a couple of journalists for a conversation about the new normal for Orlando's restaurants and what the food landscape might look like on the other side of the pandemic. Well, Amy Drew Thompson is the Orlando Sentinel's multimedia food reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Fayaz Kara. He's the Orlando Weekly's restaurant critic. Fayaz, thanks as well.
Thank you, Matt.
And Matt Hinckley, the owner of Hinckley Fancy Meats. Matt, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Let's start by looking back a week or two. Things shut down bit by bit. First, the bars were told to close, then restaurants were told to reduce their capacity. Now there's nothing but takeout service. Matt, what did you have to do to stay open?
We found ourselves in the same, the predicament that everyone is in is sort of having to reinvent their business to more of a grocery delivery model or a takeout model. I think prior to this COVID-19, we have, if you were a catering company and focused on weddings or, like fine dining restaurant and doing high-end meals, or kind of what we do is a sandwich shop or meat place. It doesn't matter what you were. I think once this virus hit, we've all sort of become the same thing. And it's, now it's like everybody's moving toward that model where we're doing takeout and sort of grocery delivery.
Right. And you're in the Easthead Market. Do you get a lot of foot traffic? Is that sort of your bread and butter, if you'll pardon the pun, on a weekend especially?
We normally have a pretty good amount of traffic, foot traffic at the market. That seems to have slowed significantly. A lot of the people that are coming in now are people who have placed pre-orders for pickup. There's a little bit of people doing delivery. There's a couple different things that the market has done. There's an initiative that the market itself is doing to provide delivery. And then our business, Hinckley Fancy Meats, is also doing delivery. And, we have some of Old Hearth's bread going out on our delivery trucks. We have Skybird Juices going out as well. Ever Oak Farm shares are going out with delivery. So we've all sort of reinvented to sort of meet the demand of people staying at home and figuring out how we can get our products to them so they don't have to leave the house.
And I noticed a week or two back you were offering free peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to anybody, no questions asked. Did you get a lot of takers on that?
We've had a few takers on it. I think that as this sort of drags out, we may see an influx of that. I don't know. We've had some people come up and order them. We're going to continue to do that as long as we can. We may continue to do it after this is all over. It feels good to do it. But I would imagine as people, as the unemployment rate continues to climb and people start running out of savings, that may pick up a little bit. We certainly hope not, but we'll try to be there for people, as the demand for that, unfortunately, will probably increase.
Well, Amy Drew Thompson, you profiled a couple of restaurants recently for the Sentinel. You talked to them about the impact of coronavirus on their business, Equilibre, not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and Big Belly's Hawaiian Grinds. What did those restaurant owners tell you?
Much the same that anyone will tell you, is that business is down. I think in the time since I did that story, Big Belly's has reduced its hours down to 2 days a week. Nisi over at Equilibre is still open, but business is still pretty slow, and she's taking some time. She had just re-signed a 3-year lease. So in the interim, she's being positive, and she's taking time to refresh the shop and clean everything up and redo the floors and be ready when she can open up for business in earnest. But she is still open. I think that everybody's kind of doing a lot of what Matt talked about, and they're pivoting, you know, to sort of creative models. You know, they're adding restaurants are now doing to-go cocktails, and they're doing family meals and things that could maybe get heated up or finished in the oven, that sort of thing. I think it's just they're throwing everything to the wall and seeing what sticks.
Right. Fires, you also wrote about how to help your local restaurants in this time, but you point out that everyone's hurting. I mean, the Weekly itself had to furlough staff, for example. And you also quote restaurateurs like David Chang, who said takeout and delivery isn't going to save independent restaurants. I just wonder what kind of conversations you're hearing about that restaurant owners and people in the food business are having right now.
Well, everyone is talking about Matt Hinckley's peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But apart from that, I mean, I think there's definitely some grim conversations being had. I think a big concern is the fact that winter and spring are heavy months for restaurants. And, you know, we typically see a dip as the summer rolls around. So these are supposed to be the money-making months. And instead, all these restaurants are taking hits. And, you know, assuming we'll be somewhat out of the woods by this summer, again, that's the low season. And the fear is that many restaurants just won't be able to survive. You know, when I did my story, I talked to Jason Chin, who runs Osri Tavern and Bagel Sushi and Reyes with Galleria. And he said this has without a doubt been the most extreme and trying times he's ever experienced. And Josh Oakley at 1921 in Mount Dora said he had to lay off a significant number of staff. And it was the hardest thing he's ever done in his career, hands down. So there are countless such stories, and it's just awful. One chef told me that the uncertainty of it all is so beyond any of the typical stresses that come, you know, with this line of work, that he feels that venturing into like this uncharted territory, making contingency plans for like multiple different scenarios, it's just been all incredibly stressful. And even Henry Mosso, who was just nominated for a James Beard Award, he had to close Kabuki Sushi on Sand Lake Road, and he furloughed the entire staff. And his restaurant on Colonial Drive, he furloughed, I think, 70% of the staff there. So it's just really, really awful. And I think, you know, one thing all of them are talking about, I think, is the fact that an industry bailout is really needed, and they all need financial help and assistance, not just from, I think, all the levels of government, but from insurance companies as well, specifically business disruption insurance that many policies don't typically cover.
Matt Hinckley, I wonder what you think about that. Is that sort of something that's going through your mind? Like, it's well and good to ask the local community, people who patronize your business, to step up and help out in this time of need, but down the line, is that going to be enough? And are you sort of thinking about what kind of help there may be from the local authorities or federal government even?
Yeah, I think that certainly we want to lean as much as we can on our local clientele. I think that ultimately the people that are going to bail us out are the people that are the ones in line at our shops every day. I think that a more immediate impact would just be to suspend any sort of like sales tax and other like things that, that we're all having to pay. Payroll taxes are a big number every week. For an immediate relief, I would start with that. And then anything else that's coming from a federal level is great. But I think that, we're going to help each other out of this. I have more faith in sending out deliveries to names I recognize every week than I have faith in any other sort of stipend coming from a federal level or even a state level.
I wonder too, I mean, are some establishments a little bit better positioned to cope with the sudden change in how they're having to operate, like people who are already doing takeout or maybe businesses that are a little bit smaller and leaner and can pivot more easily?
I think so. I think it's easier for the smaller business to maneuver. You know, we're small enough that we can change our model, like, you know, pretty quickly. I think it's a lot, you know, if you think of the small business like a canoe and a big business like a battleship, it's a lot easier to turn that canoe around on a dime and change your model. You know, for us, we started off as a model that was shipping nationwide and got a lot of good press from the New York Times and others doing that. So we sort of had this skeleton built online that required very little modification for us. Instead of shipping boxes to, you know, New York City and Seattle and, you know, Arizona or LA, we just shifted it. So we're not really shipping outside of the Orlando area now. So, you know, for us, it was something that already sort of existed. We just kind of backburnered a little bit to focus on the sandwiches and the stuff going out at the market. But I think it'll be a little bit difficult for, you know, some of the bigger, you know, if you have 4, 5, 6 locations, I think it'll be a little bit of a different scenario. But I said before, most of the deliveries that we have going out are names that I recognize. It's our locals and the people that are in the market regularly. They're the ones that are helping us to pull through this. And I think that's sort of a benefit that we have. You know, I think some of it's location. I think some of it's being involved with the local community that's helping us out a lot. I really feel for a lot of these restaurants out west that rely on that sort of transient, you know, tourist traffic where they're just seeing different faces all the time. I think that's going to be a much harder model to keep afloat in these difficult times.
Well, let me ask you that question then. Fires, theme parks have closed, and the, you know, the tourism industry has taken a real hit. Fewer visitors to Orlando means presumably fewer people patronizing restaurants. And you've written before about the kind of notion that Orlando is not this chain restaurant wasteland that some people might think it has. There was that kind of tiff with Andrew Zimmern a while back. But is this a future that Orlando might be looking at if independent restaurants take a while to rebuild on the other side of this?
Well, I think that's the fear anyway, that only the corporate-backed fat cats and chains will survive this. When I wrote my story, Norman Van Aken, he told me that it really worries for the young chefs and restaurateurs in their 30s and 40s that are being financially crushed by the pandemic. And he worries that it'll effectively negate the gains that our restaurant scene has made over the past decade or so. I mean, I guess it's a legitimate fear, but, you know, despite all the opinions to read, the fact is, you know, these are unprecedented times, you know, in our industry, and nobody really knows what's going to happen next.
Amy, you've got a pretty extensive list on the Sentinel of restaurants offering takeout. How many of those places do you think are just sort of figuring out this, how to do this now, and how many would have had that established and up and running already?
I feel safe to say most of them are trying to figure it out. I talked to Chow Trin at Sushi Pop just yesterday, and he had recently opened a second location in Winter Park. He's closed that location. He's pivoted back to Oviedo, largely because of a lot of what Matt said. Here, he's got locals who have been going to Sushi Pop for a long time, and they're very devoted, and they've been coming out. But he's... you know, not set up. Like he said, if you're a pizza restaurant, you're probably killing it right now because they already have all of those things in place. So he's, you know, kind of doing it on the fly. He's doing curbside. He's got a system now because they're still doing happy hour where somebody will answer the phone and then a server will call them back on their own phone to take the order because they're getting so many phone calls and they just don't have a system that's set up for takeout.
Have any restaurants actually kind of gone off that list since you started making it, in terms of just that they've said either permanently or for the time being, you know, anyway, they can't keep their doors open?
There have been a couple who have closed, you know, one location or another location, but nobody's let me know for sure. If anybody's reached out to me, I've taken them off the list, but it's sort of a, you've got to let me know. So if any needs to be updated, they can go back into the system through that same link and let us know that their situations have changed.
You know, Matt, I think one thing that's really important is that when, you know, when this is all said and done, there's going to be a lot of trepidatious diners. You know, it's not like people are going to be flocking out to restaurants once we're given the green light to do so, right? So for these restaurants to work out the kinks of, you know, takeout and curbside and delivery right now, while they're forced to do so, I think is really vital for their long-term existence. So for Chow, for example, for him to figure it out now, I think it would be, you know, of utmost importance, because I think this is going to continue for a while, the curbside takeout model.
Well, just a final question for all of you, and I'll start with you, Fayaz. What's your advice to people who want to support the local restaurant industry and don't want to see their favorite local restaurant go under in the next couple months? What would you recommend?
Well, support, you know, like I think for people like me and Amy right now, it's kind of difficult to be critical of restaurants when really our primary goal right now is just to support them as much as we possibly can. And, you know, I know we don't know what the future is going to hold, but I have full confidence that, you know, our very food conscious restaurant going public, you know, they're not going to allow folks like Matt and these independent chefs who have a real drive and a passion and cooking is their life. You know, they're not going to allow, you know, a return to mediocrity and corporate blandness, you know, as some fear we might.
Mm-hmm. Amy, what are your thoughts? What would you recommend people do if they want to help?
As much as they can, just go out and support. I agree with Fayaz. You've got to go out. Maybe not go out, order in. Avoid where you can those third-party delivery apps, which will take what the restaurant is going to make. Buy merch if you're full and your fridge is full. Buy a t-shirt, buy a hat, and just stay on top of who's open and spread it around if you have it to spread around.
Spread the love and the money, but not the coronavirus.
Right, precisely.
Matt, I know you've got some merch, right? You've got t-shirts and the like going. Are people snapping those up in this time?
Yeah, we've got a little bit of merch. Not a lot, but maybe that's something we need to work on. I think one of the things that Fayaz had mentioned is that during these times, people are really cautious. And I think that, you know, I had mentioned a couple times that a lot of the names that we're seeing are familiar names. And I think that in times of tragedy, people gravitate toward what they're comfortable with. And I think that there's a lot of people who might not be trying out new restaurants in a time like this. And I would encourage people to do that. We're a very creative and a very industrious industry. I think you're seeing a lot of creativity come from, you know, chefs right now. Like Cadence, you know, for example, is I think $180 a head to go eat dinner there. Those guys are making like home cooked Filipino family meals now. That's a great opportunity to try like something that you might not go and eat $150 a plate dinner at their restaurant, but if you want to see what they're capable of, that's a really good opportunity to do it. So I would encourage people to maybe find some small independent restaurants that they haven't eaten yet, that they're not familiar with, and wade your feet into those waters a little bit. There's a lot of these small restaurants that are doing some really cool stuff at this time, and it's forcing a lot of them to be really creative and inventive. And I think that more than ever, they could use the support.
Well, Matt Hinckley is the owner of Hinckley Fancy Meats. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fayaz Kara is the Orlando Weekly's restaurant critic. Fayaz, thank you as well.
Thank you, Matt.
And Amy Drew Thompson, the Orlando Sentinel's multimedia food reporter. Amy, thanks so much as well.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're online at wmfe.org/intersection. The coronavirus is affecting all of the communities in Central Florida, and WMFE and WMFV are keeping you informed from Ocala and the villages to the Space Coast to Kissimmee. Independent public service journalism has never been more important than it is right now. From COVID-19 to the 2020 elections, WMFE is here to help you make sense of it all. News you trust is made possible by your support at wmfe.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.